I'm Jeff Cohen. We just might fly through today's interview with Dr. Alan Perlman. That's because he spent a number of years in the U.S. Air Force. You might not think that's the ideal setting to grow religiously, but that's exactly what happened to Dr. Perlman. And oh yeah, as you can tell by his title, he earned his medical degree along the way. Dr. Perlman, welcome to Saturday to Shabbos.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to participate in your show. I love it. Been listening to it, and I'm delighted to be a guest and to share my story with you.
We appreciate that. And just having to say that it's a small world when it comes to Orthodox Jews, because last night as I was doing some final research before the interview, I found out that we are coaching in the same softball league. So we will be on the same team tonight telling your story, and then we'll be competitors in the baseball league next month.
All right. I'm looking forward to taking down your team.
Trash talk from the doctor. I love it.
Trash talking. Yep.
All right. So let's dive into your story. And, you know, before we hear your story, it's always good to learn a little bit about your parents or grandparents to set the context of where they were holding religiously, even before you come into the picture.
My father was from Cleveland, Ohio. His father also from Cleveland, Ohio. Beyond that point, there was my father's grandfather who immigrated from Russia in the early 1900s. My father was an only child. Even back then, he was not from a particularly religious background, but he always had, growing up, a real Jewish identity. His parents would send him to a Jewish summer camp, which he spoke very fondly of. My father was a, from what I understand, he always remained connected. Marrying a Jewish woman was always a priority for him. He married my mother. But as far as religious observance, he was pretty much a novice. And on the other side, my mother was from Texas. Her father actually was observant. They also immigrated from Russia, and her family immigrated through Galveston. I think there was a large immigration through Texas also in the early 1900s. And my mother's father was observant, but he died when my mother was, I believe, about 6 years old. And afterwards, the household was not particularly observant. My mother's mother, my grandmother, was raised by her parents. One was a Jewish woman, but her father, my mother's grandfather, was Catholic. After my grandfather passed away, my grandmother married for a second time somebody who wasn't particularly, who was Jewish, but not particularly observant. And so all of the kashrut that had occurred in the household up until that point went by the wayside. She had some appreciation of what it took to keep a kosher kitchen, but kosher kitchen at that time was very arduous. It was a time when you had to pluck all of the feathers off of the chicken. It took a lot of effort. And if you weren't linked to some sort of spiritual drive or necessity to be observant, then it wasn't lasting. And I think that's what was experienced at that time.
Now let's bring you into the picture. Where does your story begin?
I grew up in Scottsdale, Arizona. My parents met, actually, my father and his father moved to Scottsdale to open up a pharmacy. They were both pharmacists. My mother, along with her brother and her, now what would have been her stepfather, and my grandmother moved from Houston to Phoenix. My parents met at the Jewish Community Center. My grandmother actually worked at the Jewish Community Center and made the shidduch between my parents. And so my father's pharmacy was in Scottsdale, Arizona. And as far as their religious education for us, it was pretty scant. So we belonged to a Reform synagogue, Temple Solel in Scottsdale. And we were basically Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur Jews. We had a Passover Seder where we really abbreviated the Seder. I can remember early on that there was a lot of conflicts between my parents over religious matters. So although both of them had some affinity towards Judaism, neither of them were observant. But my mother felt it was important for us to have some sort of religious training through the Reform Synagogue. And so I ended up taking bar mitzvah lessons, for instance. We had something called Sunday school, which I'm not sure really, you know, what it actually accomplished. But it did serve in my family to create a bit of a conflict between my parents, because my dad was very, although he was Jewishly connected, he was also connected to sports and activities. And at that time, he was coaching me in football. And every year, there was an annual conflict of as to whether I would go to Sunday school or play in the football game. And I can remember for a number of years, I would lose the starting position because I couldn't make it to practices and to a couple of the games early in the season, only to have to try to regain that later on in the season. So that was a fairly annual conflict between my parents. Eventually, they divorced when I was 11, and that was just prior to my bar mitzvah. And so my bar mitzvah, right after a divorce that was very fresh, led to a bit of a competition between my parents as to who was going to throw the best party for me. So my bar mitzvah actually went on for about 3 weeks. So after my bar mitzvah that night, my mother had a party. Then the following week, my dad hosted a party. And all I can remember from that event was that there was an enormous vat of shrimp that he served. And everybody could just take handfuls of shrimp at this bar mitzvah. And I look back, now fully observant, of course, and just chuckle that was part of the celebration. And then the following week, my dad threw another party just for my friends, which was a poker party. And, there it was. That was my bar mitzvah month, actually.
So you have a month of celebration, obviously not under the best circumstances. And what happens for you religious-wise post-bar mitzvah as you enter the high school years?
Pretty much nothing. After my bar mitzvah, there was really nothing holding me to any sort of goal religiously. I had achieved a bar mitzvah, I made a speech, and that was it. And so following graduating from high school, I went to college at Arizona State University, really had very little in the way of any sort of religious influence at the time. Although for Pesach every year, now that my father wasn't at home, I was the one responsible for putting on the Seder for our family. And so I would do these very elaborate Seders where I would focus on some contemporary issue that was going on in society that had to do with freedom and liberation and incorporate it into the Seder. And I basically cut out most of the Haggadah, left a little matzah in. And at the end, we'd talk about what was going on in the world and think about freedom and liberation for a little bit. I suppose that kept me religiously connected to a certain degree during those years. But I would say that after college, on graduating and before medical school, Birthright was not around then, but there was a discounted trip to Israel through B'nai B'rith. And I went to Israel I was motivated for some reason to go to Israel and got a real flavor of what Israeli society is about, some religious dimension as well. And I really think that the seeds of what were later to become a religious interest were planted at that time. I always reflected back on that as I was in medical school, and made me really think about what I wanted in my own life religiously as a Jew. Not that I knew anything about observance at that point, but certainly something was triggered at that point.
So from what you've said so far, you mentioned that you're going to be headed to medical school after Israel. But at the same time, in the introduction, I mentioned the U.S. Air Force. So how does that come into the picture as it relates to medical school?
So I went to medical school at Tufts, which during the time that I was in medical school, depending on the year, was the most expensive medical school in the United States to go to. And so after 1 year, realizing how expensive it was, although nowadays it wouldn't seem all that expensive at all, but it was enough for me to look for some sources of funding for medical school. And I ended up meeting with a recruiter for the Air Force, and I was sold on the idea. And I ended up joining the Air Force as a second-year medical student. So with that came an obligation to serve some time after medical school was completed. And so following my graduation from medical school in Boston, the military had the right, based on the contract, because I was in the military, to pull me into their residency. And so I wanted to do internal medicine at the time. There was an opening at a military base in San Antonio, Texas. Despite my wanting to be in a civilian program, the Air Force, their opinion trumped my own. And I wound up in San Antonio, Texas for the next 3 years.
So San Antonio, Texas, as part of the U.S. Air Force, does not sound like the setting for someone to begin thinking about religion even further. But is that where the first elements happen? I mean, you mentioned Israel gave you that little spark of understanding Judaism and the Holy Land, but now I'm thinking in a place where that would be like the least likely moment that religion would enter into your life in a bigger way. So what happens while you're in San Antonio?
I think like the Purim story, a number of things were happening at the same time for me. First of all, there was a period of my life where religious interest in Judaism specifically was not really a priority. And throughout medical school, that was the case. In my family as well, my parents being divorced, there was a time when dating and meeting a Jewish partner was not a priority for any of us. And there was a time when both of my parents and me and my siblings were dating non-Jews, all of us. It really kind of bothered me. Like, I couldn't figure out why. It just internally didn't make sense for me to pursue a non-Jewish partner during those years while I was in medical school. So when I came to San Antonio, Texas, I felt like I needed to grapple with that. So I started to seek out opportunities in the Jewish community in San Antonio. And there aren't a huge number of options, but there are some. So there's a reform, a very large reform synagogue in San Antonio. There's a conservative shul, and there's both a Chabad and another Orthodox synagogue in San Antonio, Texas. And soon after I arrived in Texas, I had a peer. He's also a physician and was also in the Air Force, also Jewish. The same year, we started our residency programs together. And really, we sort of served to influence each other to spend some time in the Jewish community in San Antonio. His name is Todd Silverman, physician, neurologist, major in the Air Force also. And we would start exploring Jewish opportunities. And I can recall being invited to my first Shabbos meal ever at a nephrologist who was in the community, invited us over, and we went to the Orthodox synagogue first time. I benched for the first time. I'm like, what is going on here? I'm looking at my watch. I'm like, is this for real? But eventually, I began to sort of get it. And I spent some time with Rabbi Block in the Chabad in San Antonio, still is there, with a growing community of his own. And at the point of time where my residency was coming to a close, he had been inviting me to spend an entire Shabbos with them from start to finish. And I had been a little bit resistant at that time, but eventually acquiesced. And right before I finished my time in San Antonio, spent a full Shabbos with Chabad. And that was really on my way out. I would add that another influence at that time, because I mentioned that a number of things were going on at once. So part of it was this internal drive to figure out why marrying somebody Jewish felt important to me when I really didn't have a reason to. And the other was the influences that I had in the community where the people were willing to outreach and just share exposure to observant Yiddishkeit. But also around that time, as a resident physician, I was faced with a lot of mortality. You know, I would be working in ICUs and see patients die and just wondering, you know, what does all this mean? What is the purpose of our existence if not for something valuable as a way to apply our life, something meaningful? And so that was also driving me at the time. And I started to pick up about a lot of books on beginner's Judaism, most of which were from an Orthodox dimension. At that time, I would still characterize myself as being a spiritual free agent. And I can remember one Rosh Hashanah, I hit for the cycle. So I was at the Reform synagogue for one services, then I was at Chabad, and then I was at the conservative shul, and then back at Rodfei Shalom. Like, I hit for everything. But what really drew me was that the Orthodox services seemed so authentic. They just seemed so authentic. I can remember during that year for Rosh Hashanah, on the balcony at the Reform synagogue, there was a trumpet player instead of a shofar. And it was beautiful, but totally out of place. And it just struck me that the upbringing that I had, the religious community that I grew up in, it just at that point felt a bit dishonest and a bit just disauthentic in a way.
I really love how you talked about hitting for the cycle, because I'm seeing that you're in real time getting to experience all these different levels of Judaism. At the same time, you called yourself a spiritual free agent, like you don't know exactly where you're going to land. And then you also said that your time in San Antonio is coming to an end. So what's the next stop, and like, where are you holding at that point as you move on from San Antonio?
So at that point, my next station was going to be in the United Kingdom, just outside of Cambridge. And I knew that Cambridge had a Jewish community, and I wasn't that far away from London. And I would say that at that point, I was really committed to pursuing this path, but not committed to a given trajectory. Like, I wanted to move at whatever pace felt right at the moment, but I wasn't going to let myself feel entirely comfortable being stationary either. So I continued to read, Fortunately, at the Air Force base that I was stationed at, one of the chaplains was an Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Brett Oxman, who would invite me over for Shabbos meals, would invite me into his sukkah. It was good to have that, an access to observant Judaism right there on the base. And so I spent a lot of time with him. But even a bigger influence, I think, at that time was another rabbi, a rabbi by the name of Rashi Simon, who was American-born but lived in England and founded an outreach organization called Kesher UK, located in London. And he basically gave me a blank check, open ticket, whatever you want to call it, to come in any Shabbos that I wanted. And there would always be a place available for me. And I really took advantage of that during the 2 years that I was stationed in England. And so I found myself driving into London often just to spend Shabbos with this family, and continued to grow in my Yiddishkeit at that time. I ended up midway during the period of time while I was living in England, I ended up koshering my kitchen, made a dairy kitchen out of it, proper pots and pans, silverware, etc. I wasn't fully Shomer Shabbos at that time, and I created a rule that I would only break Shabbos for really cool things. You know, if I could do something really cool, that would be okay to break Shabbos for. So,
what's an example of something really cool?
So, if I had an opportunity to travel to Europe with friends, you know, the mainland, or tour around, go mountain biking, you know, things like that, then I would do those things on Shabbos. But if I didn't have anything planned, I wasn't going to sit at home and watch television. I would avail myself of Rabbi Oxman and his family locally and keep Shabbos under those circumstances.
You're actually raising an important point, because if you had decided on a random Tuesday, I'm going to kosher my kitchen, I now keep Shabbos every single time, I'm wrapping tefillin every day, that could be a recipe for taking on too much too fast and then feeling overwhelmed and giving it up. So some people might say, well, how can you have this rule that you keep Shabbos except when there's something really fun to do? But it actually makes sense to me, as someone who went on my own journey, that you can't take it on all at once. You have friends around you that you either grew up with or know as a young adult that aren't religious, aren't on this journey. You're still with them, and you can't just close the door on that whole life completely overnight.
I definitely agree. I met people who turn on a switch and suddenly they're observant. And not that that was something that I was comparing myself to at that time, but it often doesn't last under those circumstances. So in my case, the pace, the growth was always there, and I didn't really have an endpoint in mind. I just wanted to keep going.
I'm wondering how your family felt about this. You talked about some religious tension from your childhood, and then your parents are divorced, and they seem to have different feelings about what religion should mean in your life. You have this buffer zone because you're in the UK, but I imagine you're checking in with them regularly. Like, how are they feeling about this growth trajectory that you're on?
So I would say, although they were a bit bewildered by my spiritual exploration, both of my parents divorced, but both completely supportive of my efforts. I think on different occasions, both of my parents purchased either pots and pans or plates or silverware. You know, they were really very supportive. You know, eventually I left England. My next posting was at Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington, D.C. At that point, I was even more fully observant. I was not yet wearing a kippah all the time, and I was still in the military at Andrews Air Force Base, but really Shomer Shabbos at that point. And I can remember my father coming for a visit to see me in Washington, D.C. You know, I was really spending 3 days with me. And he got off the plane with this huge suitcase, like a huge, heavy suitcase. And I'm like, what is he doing? And he, you know, so I schlep it in the car, we get to my apartment, we get it upstairs somehow, and he opens the suitcase, and inside he had purchased and prepared an entire Shabbos meal that he brought from Phoenix to share with me and my friends. And so in that suitcase were, I think, a new set of plates and some wine. I don't know if it was wine glasses or something, but it was like everything was packed into this, and he really just was there to share in Shabbos with me. So he wanted the connection and really wanted to show support. Similarly, my mother was always very supportive. You know, it wasn't something that really resonated with her, but she was always very encouraging about exploring Yiddishkeit. And never had a difficult problem with either of my parents, with the exception of one time, which was the year that I separated from the military. I was living in Washington, D.C., and I decided at that point that I would like to go to yeshiva. And so I planned to go to yeshiva at Dar Hinnom at Chappelle's and Beit Dekarim in Jerusalem. This was during the Second Intifada. And here were my divorced and highly supportive parents finding commonality in their desire for me not to go to Israel that year. So at least I could say that I brought them back together in a certain way.
But I'm guessing you found a way to go. I mean, you're an adult at this point. I mean, they can be not 100% supportive, but it's really coming from fear, I guess, of something dangerous happening to you while you're there.
Absolutely. I ended up traveling for part of the year and then spent the most of that period of time in between separating from the military and then doing a nephrology fellowship. And so I ended up going to Chappelle's.
So how long were you there? And did that give you this feeling of like the yeshiva education you never had all consolidated down to some shorter time period than what a day school kid gets by having 15 years of it?
I can't say that that was the case. I had no idea what to expect. I just knew that I was still a neophyte and I wanted something more. And I just thought that I was ready to immerse myself a bit in a learning environment, not really knowing what I was going to be learning. I really had very little clue what I was going to encounter there. But it was definitely worthwhile. And I left even more committed at that point. And then I started a fellowship in Washington, D.C. And at that point, I can remember returning from Israel and then getting to D.C. and starting my fellowship and wondering, am I going to wear my kippah? I've been wearing it, you know, the entire time I was in Israel, no reason not to. Am I going to do this or not? And by the way, when I had my interview for that fellowship, I didn't wear a kippah. So here I am coming back from Israel, taking a year off, and what's it going to be? So I think I decided that morning on my way in, I just put it on my head and that was that. And once you do it, you're done, you know?
So when you were going through the interview, was the thought, I don't want to be judged by this kippah. Like I want to go through the interview and have them just see me based on the answers that I give. I don't want them to have any preconceived notions about me. Like what was the fear during the interview that you then overcame after that?
You know, I had good trajectory with my religious growth, but putting a keep on full time, it felt like that made it official. Like there's no turning back. You know, there's not an off ramp. Once you start wearing the kippah and you're public about it and everybody sees you that first week, you take it off. What are you going to, you're going to explain this to everybody that you're in a, you know, some spiritual turmoil. You know, once it's on, that's it. The lid is on. And there it was. It took a moment of bravery, I think, at that time. It's still not, you know, I might have been 95% at that time, 98%. But that really, you know, was like the final distance.
When I think about the way you're telling that story, I can remember how a lot of the steps you can do privately and no one really even knows that you're doing them. You can start eating kosher, you can start going to shul, you can wrap tefillin, like you can do a lot of things privately. But that kippah is there for everybody to see and it opens the door to questions about how you've changed your life. It opens the door to people judging you before they even talk to you. So you really have to build up like that inner confidence that, all right, I'm all in and I'm willing to show the world that this is who I am now.
Exactly. So I was wearing a kippah for a while before my parents actually saw me wearing a kippah full time. You know, I'd be, prior to that point, I'd go to Phoenix and I'd wear a kippah at shul, but I wasn't wearing it all the time. I can recall my family coming in for a visit, my mother and my father separately, and wondering, how am I going to explain this? They were cool with everything up until now. Are they going to be cool when this is really like public? I was a bit nervous. My mother in particular, she kept real cool. My father also, you know, explained a few things sort of sheepishly, and then that was that.
And so your story then takes you to New York, and is that where a special someone comes in your life that is Jewish as opposed to the stories you're telling of your family dating non-Jews?
Yes, absolutely. So I think it is absolutely fortuitous that I met my wife in New York City. My wife, Honey, worked in a Kiruv organization at MJE, Manhattan Jewish Experience, in the city. And the story of our connection is one thing, but we actually met in Manhattan Jewish Experience, Simchas Torah. And it was just a real natural fit, you know, to meet somebody whose whole career is in the Kiruv environment, just seemed very natural. And, you know, she met my family. I met her family around that time. And everything just fell into place. Thank God. Now we have 5 children, moved out of the city and live in Bergenfield. My wife was from Parsippany, New Jersey, and her family actually founded the Orthodox Shul in Parsippany, New Jersey. And I think her background also applies to this, is of welcoming people who were not particularly connected into their living room, because that's where the shul was for an extended period of time. And so she got to see firsthand how religiously novice individuals can be turned on by Yiddishkeit. And it became a passion for her. And she has been with MJE for, I think, 23 years at this point, 24 years, was there from the founding of the organization. Very proud of her, love her very much, and I'm so proud of her being the mother of our children.
And by the way, I should mention that we interviewed Rabbi Wilds, who runs Manhattan Jewish Experience, on this podcast, because we often interview people who have their own journeys, but I also like to talk to people working Kirov to see what is this all like from their perspective. And it was a great, really fascinating interview.
He's a fantastic and gifted leader of that organization.
Now, I realize there's one question I didn't get to ask you about your journey. I know where you are now today, but when you were talking about the Air Force, you're going through this personal growth. How supportive are they being as you're changing in front of their very eyes of what you eat, what you're willing to do on a Saturday? What's that experience for you while you're in the Air Force?
Most of my religious journey took place either in England or when I was back in DC afterwards. And throughout the entire time, I had no issues whatsoever with the military environment. First of all the bases have a commissary, which is like a grocery store, and they all have kosher food in them. You know, they all have American products. In the middle of farmlands in England where the Air Force base was, here I could get all the American products I wanted, including kosher wine. It was all available. So the environment was good. As for my superiors, they were all particularly supportive. I remember there was one Hanukkah where I was a captain, and the major, who was my most direct senior officer, was insistent that I take all 8 days off for Hanukkah. And I tried to explain that it's not really one of these holidays that I have to take off. And she was absolutely adamant that every day be taken off. So I had 8 consecutive days off. She was an African American woman who felt that she was being subjected to some unfair treatment. And I think she was bending over backwards to be deferential to my religious needs at the time. So that was terrific. That was great. The next year, she didn't let me do that, though.
So I'm trying to think about your whole story now in its entirety. The last question I just want to ask you, given where this whole thing started in Scottsdale and how far you've taken it today, when you reflect back on that journey, like, what really comes to mind about everything you went through to get where you are at this point?
I would have to say that having access to supportive individuals in every community that I was at, people who are welcoming, non-judgmental, who could, who are willing to open up their doors and share a Shabbos meal and allow me to stay over Shabbos. And there's a lot of individuals, many not mentioned in our conversation, who along the way were just very welcoming and willing to accept me at whatever point that I was at. So I think that was a big part of it. I didn't mention this, but I did go 1 year to a Jewish summer camp in Arizona. I don't remember much about that Jewish summer camp, except that over dinner, they would sometimes tell stories and fables. And there was a story about a landlord and a tenant, and he had 2 tenants. Both of the tenants were poor and couldn't pay their bills. And one tenant, though, throughout the years, was always very courteous to the landlord and was always made a point to go out of his way and to develop a relationship. And the other tenant never really did. And when it came time to insist on payment from the 2 tenants, it was the one tenant who had developed a relationship with the landlord for whom, you know, he dropped the need to make rental payments until he could get back on his feet. And the metaphor was that the landlord was Hashem, and that if we make our own effort to make a connection, that connection will come back to us. And for some reason, I always remember that story, which was told in this Reform summer camp. But I always remember that. And it, for some reason, it kind of carried me a little bit, you know, that you have to put in a little bit of effort if you want some reward.
That is a beautiful story to end on. So I just want to say, Dr. Perlman, given your background in the Air Force, Thank you for not flying through your answers. And I really appreciate you joining me today on Saturday to Shabbos.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed speaking with you tonight. That was great.
Saturday to Shabbos is produced by Gary Wallach. Our theme music is by Paul Uden. To learn more about us, please visit TachlisMedia.com. That's TachlisMedia.com. Tell us what you think about what you've heard, or suggest a story we should know about by emailing Shabbos@TachlisMedia.com. I'm Jeff Cohen. Thanks for listening. Please check with us often for more stories of inspiring Jewish journeys. Saturday to Shabbos is a Tachlis Media podcast.